Democracy doesn't work without citizen activism and participation starting at the community. Trickle-down politics don't work much better than trickle-down economics. Civilization happens because we don't leave things to other people. What's right and good doesn't come naturally. You have to stand up and argue and fight for it as if the cause depends on you. Allow yourself that conceit to believe that the flame of democracy will never go out as long as there's one candle in your hand.
This is a special 4th of July edition of Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. With campaigning well underway for the 2004 presidential election, organizations working for progressive social change are strategizing for how to work together to win back political power. Speaking at the Take Back America conference held in the nation's capital last month, journalist and former presidential aide Bill Moyers was given the America's Future Lifetime Leadership Award. He delivered a major address entitled, "This Is Your Story, the Progressive Story of America, Pass It On," in which he outlined the history of the progressive movement in the U.S. and where the movement should go from here.
Thank you for those words, for this award, and for this occasion. I don't deserve any of it, but as George Burns said, I have arthritis and I don't deserve that either. But I do have to ask you one question. I have to ask you, why only one award? The right wing did better than this. 2 weeks ago, I got two awards from them on one occasion here in Washington. I'm not making this up. Right here in Washington, the vast right-wing conspiracy selected me for two of their annual dishonor awards, given every year to the most outrageously biased liberal journalists. I came tonight to apologize for getting only two, and to assure you that I'm going to try to do better and get three next year. I'm also ashamed to admit that I didn't work very hard for those awards. All I did was report on what I saw on Fox News. I save a lot of money watching Fox because now I don't have to buy any more comic books. I was told, by the way, that the judges agonized over whether or not to give me one or two awards. The judges were Steve Forbes, Rush Limbaugh, Robert Novak, Cal Thomas, and Luciana Goldberg, among others. I mean, being accused of bias by that crowd is like being charged with homicide by Charles Manson, Jack the Ripper, and the Boston Strangler. My first award was presented by Ann Coulter. I think it was Ann Coulter. It might have been Grover Norquist. But as Bill Bennett would put it, don't bet on it. Anyway, the good news is that I didn't have to be present in person to accept the awards. They just burned me in effigy. So you can understand what a pleasure it is to be here tonight. It's great to be with so many progressives and no one's getting arrested. Tomorrow is my 69th birthday. And I cannot imagine a better present than this award and your company. 53 years ago tomorrow, on my 16th birthday, I went to work for the daily newspaper in the small East Texas town where I grew up. It was a good place to be a cub reporter, small enough to navigate, but big enough to keep me busy and learning something every day. I soon had a stroke of luck. Some of the old-timers were out on vacation or out sick, and I got assigned to cover what came to be known as the Housewives' Rebellion. 15 women in my hometown decided not to pay the Social Security withholding tax for their domestic workers. They argued that Social Security was unconstitutional, that imposing it was taxation without representation, and that, here's my favorite part, requiring us to collect the tax is no different from requiring us to collect the garbage. They hired themselves a lawyer, none other than Martin Dies, the former congressman best known or worst known for his work as head of the House Committee on Un-American Activities in the 30s and 40s. He was no more effective at defending rebellious women than he was protecting against communist subversives. And eventually, the women wound up holding their noses and paying the tax. The stories I wrote for my local paper were picked up and moved on to the Associated Press wire. One day, the managing editor called me over and pointed to the AP ticker beside his desk, and moving across the wire was a notice to editors citing one Bill Moyers and the paper for the reporting we had done on the rebellion. That hooked me. And in one way or another, after a detour through seminary and then into politics and government for a spell, I've been covering the class war ever since. Those women in Marshall were not bad people. They were regulars at church. Their children were my friends. They were active in community affairs. Their husbands were pillars of the business and professional class in town. They were respectable and upstanding citizens in all. So it took me a while to figure out what had brought on that spasm of reactionary rebellion. And it came to me one day, many years later. They simply couldn't see beyond their own prerogatives. Fiercely loyal to their families, to their clubs, charities, and congregations, fiercely loyal, in other words, to their own kind, they narrowly defined membership in democracy to include only people like them. The women who washed and ironed their laundry, wiped their children's bottoms, made their husbands' beds, and cooked their family meals. These women, too, would grow old and frail, sick and decrepit, lose their husbands, and face the ravages of time alone, with nothing to show from their years of labor but the crease in their brow and the knots on their knuckles. So be it, it was said. Even on the distaff side of laissez-faire, security was personal, not social, and what injustice existed this side of heaven would no doubt be redeemed beyond the pearly gates. God was just once you got past Judgment Day. In one way or another, this is the oldest story in America. The struggle to determine whether we, the people, is a spiritual idea embedded in a political reality, one nation, indivisible, or merely a charade masquerading as piety and manipulated by the powerful and privileged to sustain their own way of life at the expense of others. Let me make it clear. I don't harbor any idealized notion of politics and democracy. I worked for Lyndon Johnson, remember? Nor do I romanticize the people. You should read my mail or listen to the anonymous messages left on my answering machine. And I remember the politician who said of the Texas House of Representatives, if you think these guys are bad, you should see their constituents. But there is nothing idealized or romantic about the difference between a society whose arrangements roughly serve all its citizens or one whose institutions have been converted into a stupendous fraud. That difference is often the difference between democracy and oligarchy. as Maria indicated a moment ago, and Regina, we all know that the American Revolution ushered in what one historian called the Age of Democratic Revolutions. For the great seal of the United States, the new Congress went all the way back to the Roman poet Virgil, Novus Ordo Seclorum, a new age now begins. Their ambition was not merely to free themselves from the independence and subordination to the crown, but to inspire people everywhere to create agencies of government and forms of common social life that would offer greater dignity and hope to the exploited and suppressed, to those who had long been the losers. Not surprisingly, the winners resisted. In the early years of constitution making in the states and the emerging nation, aristocrats wanted a government of propertied gentlemen to keep the scales tilted in their favor. Badly on the other side were moderates and even those radicals advocating the extraordinary idea of letting all white males have the vote. Luckily, the weapons were words and ideas, not bullets, and through compromise and conciliation, the draftsmen achieved a constitution of checks and balances that is now the oldest in the world, even as the revolution of democracy that inspired it remains a tempestuous adolescent whose destiny is still uncertain. The American Revolution is ongoing, growing by painful and often tentative steps and many times losing ground. For all the rhetoric about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it took a civil war to free the slaves and another 100 years to invest their freedom with meaning. Women only gained the right to vote in my mother's time because new ages don't arrive overnight or without blood, sweat, and tears. You know this. You are the heirs of one of the country's great traditions, the progressive movement that started late in the 19th century and remade the American experience piece by piece until it peaked in the third part of the 20th century. I call it the progressive movement for lack of a more precise term. Its aim was to keep blood pumping through the veins of democracy when others were willing to call in the mortician. Progressives exalted and extended the American Revolution. They spelled out new terms of partnership between the people and their rulers, and they kindled a flame that lit some of the most prosperous decades in modern history, not only here, but in aspiring democracies everywhere, especially those in Western Europe. I want to tell you a story. And to begin that story, I want to ask you to step back with me to the curtain raiser, to the founding convention of the People's Party, better known as the Populists in 1892. The members were mainly cotton and wheat farmers from the recently reconstructed South and the newly settled Great Plains, and they had come on hard, hard times, driven to the wall by falling prices for their crops on one hand and racking interest rates, freight charges, and supply costs on the other. This in the midst of a booming and growing industrial America. They were angry, and their platform, issued deliberately on the 4th of July, pulled no punches. "We meet," it said, "in the midst of a nation brought to the verge of moral, political, and material ruin. Corruption dominates the ballot box, the state legislatures, and the Congress, and touches even the bench." The newspapers, I'm reading from the platform, the newspapers are largely subsidized or muzzled, public opinion silenced, and the fruits of the toil of millions are boldly stolen to build up colossal fortunes for a few. Furious words from rural men and women who were traditionally conservative and whose memories of taming the frontier were fresh and personal. But in their fury, they invoked an American tradition as powerful as frontier individualism, the war on inequality, and especially on the role that government played in promoting and preserving inequality by favoring the rich. The founding fathers had turned their backs on the idea of property qualifications for holding office under the Constitution because they wanted no part of a veneration for wealth in the document. Thomas Jefferson, while claiming no interest in politics, built a Republican Party, no kin to the present, to take the government back from the speculators and stock jobbers, as he called them, who were in the saddle in 1800. Andrew Jackson slew the monster Second Bank of the United States, that 600-pound gorilla of the credit system of the 1830s, in the name of the people versus the aristocrats who sat on the boards, on the bank's governing board. All of these leaders, I don't have to remind you, were on record in favor of small government, but their opposition wasn't simply to government as such. It was the government's power to confer privilege on insiders, on the rich who were democracy's equivalent of the royal favorites of monarchy. You know, it's what the FCC did this week. The populace saw that it was the government that granted millions of acres of public land to the railroad builders. It was the government that gave the manufacturers of farm machinery a monopoly of the domestic market by a protective tariff that was no longer necessary to shelter infant industries. It was the government that contracted the national currency and sparked a deflationary cycle that crushed debtors and fattened the wallets of creditors. And those who made the great fortunes then used them to buy the legislative and judicial favors that kept them on top. So the populace recognized one great principle: the job of preserving equality of opportunity and democracy demanded the end of that unholy alliance between government and wealth. It was, to quote that same platform again, from the same womb of governmental injustice that both tramps and millionaires were made. But how? How to restore government to the job of promoting the general welfare? And here the populace made a breakthrough to another principle. In a modern, large-scale, industrial, and nationalized economy, it simply wasn't enough to curb the government's outreach. That would simply leave power in the hands of the great corporations whose existence was inseparable from growth and progress. The answer was to turn government into an active player in the economy, at the very least enforcing fair play, and when necessary, being the friend, the helper, and the agent of the people at large in their eternal struggle against organized power. So, the populist platform called for government loans to farmers about to lose their mortgaged homesteads, for government granaries to grade and store their crops fairly, for governmental inflation of the currency, which was a classical plea of debtors, and for some decidedly non-classical actions like government ownership of the railroad, telephone, and telegraph systems, and a graduated, that is, progressive tax on incomes, and a flat ban on subsidies, quote, to any private corporation. And to make sure the government stayed on the side of the people, the POPs call for the initiative and referendum and the direct election of senators. Predictably, the populace were denounced, feared, and mocked as fanatical hayseeds ignorantly playing the socialist fire. They got 22 electoral votes for their candidate in 92, plus some congressional seats and state houses, but it was downhill from there for many reasons. America wasn't, and probably still isn't, ready for a new major party. And by 1904, the populist party was a spent rocket. But if political organizations perish, their ideas don't. Keep that in mind. Indeed, much of the populist agenda would become law within a few years of the party's extension, and that was because it was generally shared by a rising generation of young Republicans and Democrats who, justly or not, were seen as less outrageously outdated than the embattled farmers. These were your forebears and mine. These were the progressives. One of my heroes in all of this was a man whose almost every word I read growing up, William Allen White, a Kansas country editor, a Republican who was one of them. And he described the group this way: what the people felt about the vast injustice that had come with the settlement of the continent, we, their servants, teachers, city councilors, legislators, governors, publishers, editors, writers, representatives in Congress and senators, we all made a part of our creed. Some way, he wrote, into the hearts of the dominant middle class of this country had come a sense that their civilization needed recasting, that their government had fallen into the hands of self-seekers, and that a new relationship would be established between the haves and the have-nots. They were a diverse group, held together by a common admiration of progress, hence the name, and a shared dismay at the paradox of poverty stubbornly persisting in the midst of progress like an unwanted guest at a wedding. Of course, they welcomed, as we do, the new marvels in the gift bag of technology, the telephones, the autos, the electrically powered urban transport and lighting systems, the indoor heating and plumbing, the processed foods and home appliances, and machine-made clothing that reduced the sweat and drudgery of homemaking and were affordable to an ever-swelling number of people. But they saw the underside, too. The slums lurking in the shadows of the glittering cities, the exploited and unpredicted workers whose low-paid labor filled the horn of plenty for others, the misery of those whom age, sickness, accident, and hard times condemned to servitude and poverty with no hope of comfort and security. You know, this is what's hard to believe. Within 100 years after 1776, while the still young revolution was still in its infancy, it was being strangled in the hard grip of a ruling class. The large corporations that were called into being by modern industrialization after 1865, the end of the Civil War, had combined into trusts, making minions of both politicians and government. What Henry George called an immense wedge was being forced through American society by the maldistribution of wealth, status, and opportunity. I'm here to remind you that this is Karl Rove's cherished period of American history. It was, as I read him, and I've read a lot about him, the seminal influence on the man who is said to be George W.'s brain. I am not making this up. Karl Rove has modeled the Bush presidency on that of William McKinley, who was in the White House from 1897 to 1901, and modeled himself on Mark Hanna, the man who virtually manufactured McKinley. Hanna served corporate and imperial power. It was said of him that he believed, quote, without compunction, that the state of Ohio, like the state of Texas today, existed for property. It had no other function. Great wealth was to be gained through monopoly, through using the state for private ends. It was axiomatic, therefore, that businessmen should run the government and run it for personal profit. I'm not making this up. You can read those ideas every day on the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal. Just the other day, they said the people who don't make enough money to pay taxes are lucky duckies. And a few weeks ago, they ran a column in which they said the only real problem with the economy is that it is so boring, that it used to be social fun to talk about stocks. Mark Hanna, Karl Rove's hero, made William McKinley governor of Ohio by shaking down the corporatist interests of the day, the pioneers and rangers of their time. McKinley had the invaluable gift of emitting sonorous platitudes as though they were recently discovered truth. Under his pleasant gaze and through the wily intrigues of Mark Hanna, first Ohio and then Washington were ruled by business, by bankers, by railroads, and by public utility corporations. And any who opposed this oligarchy as Unionite were smeared as disturbers of the peace, socialists, anarchists, or workers. Back then, they didn't bother with hollow euphemisms like compassionate conservatism to disguise the raw reactionary politics that produce government of, by, and for the ruling corporate class. They just saw the loot and went for it. The historian Clinton Rossiter describes this as the period of the great train robbery of American intellectual history. Conservatives, or better, pro-corporate apologists, hijacked the vocabulary of Jeffersonian liberalism and turned words like progress, opportunity, and individualism into tools for making the rape of America sound like a consensual date. Charles Darwin's theory of evolution was hijacked too, so that conservative politicians, judges, and publicists promoted as if it were the natural order of things, the notion that progress resulted from the elimination of the weak and the survival of the fittest. And this degenerate and unlovely age, as one historian calls it, exists in the mind of Karl Rove, the brain of George W. Bush, remember, as the seminal age of inspiration. I guess I deserve their award after all.
You're listening to a special holiday edition of Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, we'll continue with Bill Moyer's speech at the Take Back America conference.